Accession number 28660, Captain Robert Bonner, Pill 2. Now, we were talking about the training you underwent with the 29th Junior Leader Battalion, which is an intensive course of training. Well, we talked about weapons training, fitness training. Was there any other aspects of the training you'd undergo during perhaps a typical day?
There was also the educational programmes, which were...
Yes, they were
considered to be quite important, although I don't think many of us took much notice of them at the time. These were run by NCOs of the Army Educational Corps, and the actual name of the programme escapes me, but it was really a question of current affairs and world affairs. To try and sort of, I suppose, broaden our outlook. And these were compulsory parades, but I don't think on the whole that they were much appreciated. It was about this stage in our training that selection was being made as to who was going to, who wasn't going to make the grade first of all, and who would be returned returned to their own unit.
How was the selection process carried out?
Well, I think this was very much an ongoing situation between held by the company commander, invariably a major at the time, and his second in command, a captain, and the senior NCOs of the who commanded the platoons. And we had commissioned officers as platoon commanders as well. So there was probably a group of 3 to 6 people who were measuring us up all the time. And after a certain amount of time, a matter of weeks, those who were either considered unfit or physically unfit or not going to make the grade, were sent off to their parent regiments and disappeared, which
what
left...
What happened to them? They just become
They just go back as ordinary recruits and carry on with their basic training.
Well, this is the first phase of what would be of the selection
process. Yes.
Just ask, other forms of training, was there any tactical training in the early stage, sort of exercises and attacking, that sort of thing?
There was tactical training, platoon section and platoon training. But this was all done under the control of the training officers. So we just did as we were told. We weren't expected to take any particular forms of leadership at that stage.
No, I mean, what sort of things did they have you doing? Mock attacks or what?
Simple mock attacks and giving covering support to each other in sections and platoons. Nothing very complicated.
Any other forms of training in the first phase?
No, not that I can think of. No.
When you sort of
we had a fairly pretty full program with what I've been telling you.
So you did till lunch. Well, you had a break in the morning for your milk and your cake, and then lunch, a decent meal. Afternoon. What time would the day finish, roughly speaking? Or rather, the training program finish.
Training probably finished about 3:30, 4 o'clock, 3:30, and then break for evening meal, and then perhaps some lectures.
On what sort of subject? Educational lectures.
Educational
lectures.
Educational lectures.
Mm. So we sort of covered. Now, what about what they call the bull side of it? If you see what I mean, was there a lot of concentration on? Preparations for, say, kit inspection, both personally, your uniform and kit, and your room, your hut room. Tell us a bit about how you prepare for a kit inspection. What level of preparation?
Well, there was barrack room inspection every day of the week, and on Saturdays there was the company commander's kit inspection. On each day, everything had to be perfect. And it had to be absolutely super perfect for the company commander's inspection on the Saturday morning.
So what do you mean by, how let's take the room preparations for the suit.
Well, the floors have to be polished, cleaned and polished every evening, every night. Large, enormous sort of 2 gallon tins of floor polish. These have to be polished by hand and then buffed up with great buffing brooms. The coal bins and the, what do we call them, the stoves had to be covered in, had to be blackened up and polished. There had not got to be a speck of dust anywhere on a windowsill, on top of a cupboard or anywhere underneath the bed. Every item of brass in the on your uniform had to be polished.
With Brasso?
With Brasso. And gaiters and spare gaiters and spare webbing belt had to be blankoed.
Now, that's something that people don't understand now. And no. Years when we were all there.
Quite.
Well, what is blanko? Because they can't understand, A, what it is, and B, what the point is.
No. Not much point, okay.
What is blanko? I mean, how do you do it?
Well, blanko is like a toothpaste in a round tin, and you apply a wet sponge to the blanko, and then you rub it carefully into your webbing, whether it's your webbing belt, your gaiters, your brain gun pouches, your cross belts, or your haversack. There was an awful lot of material to be covered in blanko, and it had to be done accurately and properly worked out, because if you put too much blanko on, then it would be the inspecting NCO or officer will throw it on the floor and jump on it or kick it out of the window. But blankoing did take a lot of time.
Where did it dry? I mean,
blankoing was usually done outside, weather permitting, because it would be inclined to make too much of a mess internally. Boots had to be polished. The requisite number of studs in the boots had always got to be there and had to be polished. Underneath of the soles of the boots had to be polished and gleaming.
How much of a buff? I mean, in some units, they have almost a parade set of boots and a normal set of boots. And how much of a shine were you expected to get on your heels?
Yes, everybody had two pairs of boots, one for normal day-to-day duties and the other one for parade. And the people would spend hours sitting on their beds at night with a hot candle, the end of a metal spoon, boning, as the expression was, boning their boots to get a high polish on.
Is that to get the smooth surface?
Get the smooth surface.
Then polish.
Yes, because you start off with an ordinary basic ammunition boot, which is just rough leather. By the time you finish with it, it is as smooth as patent leather, and it's got to be kept that way. So people literally would spend hours and hours just cleaning and polishing their boots.
And was it really spit and polish? Was they still doing that?
Oh yes, very much so. Yes, yes, and it works. I still do it.
Did you enjoy it? I mean, did you enjoy the satisfaction of having well turned out kit?
Oh yes, yes, indeed. But apart from the satisfaction, there was also the constant fear at the back of your mind that if it wasn't up to standard, then you were in for trouble, and that could lead to a great many inconveniences.
Was there a set way of laying out your kit on the bed still?
Yes, there was this. Blankets had to be, I think there were four blankets. They had to be folded up in a special manner, and for those who were extra keen, then there was a long, thin piece of wood, like a 12-inch rule, put behind the front of the blanket to stiffen it up and give a rigid appearance. The outer blanket had to be folded carefully and no edges shown, and everything else had to be absolutely in the position laid down by the sergeant, and woe betide you if it was in the wrong position or anything was not there. So it was, granted there's a great deal of purpose behind it all, because A, you know you've got it, and B, the person who's in charge of you knows that it's in good condition. So although that might not appreciate it at the time, I think most of us really did.
Now, how did you get on with the other lads? Were they from the same sort of background as yourself? Was there any bullying? What was the between the recruits, what was the relationship like?
in my experience, there was never any bullying. We were all of the same age. We came from the widest variety of backgrounds that you could think of. We had a mixture of public school boys from Eton and many of the lesser public schools. There were a few grammar school boys, but the majority, I suppose, were the normal comprehensive schools that there were at that time. So it was a complete cross-section of backgrounds and educational, and it worked extraordinarily well.
You gelled.
Everybody gelled. And when I say that, in that little group of my, out of that 30, one went on to be a major general, at least one went on to be a brigadier, and there were others. So, they were probably the shining stars, but there were others who did equally well in other forms of life. So it was a very interesting mixture of people, but it worked extraordinarily well.
Yeah. Tell me about the relationship with your instructors, because that's a very important, you know, the NCO instructors, that's a very important part of training. How did you get on with them, and what were their methods and attitudes like?
These were men who had all, apart from the very junior NCOs, these were all men who had actually served in World War II and who were highly experienced. They looked after us looking back after all these years, I would say they looked after us in a very genuine and in many cases, fatherly manner. They chased us around whilst they were on duty. But the sergeant in charge of each platoon lived in a little room at the end of each barrack room. And when the day's work was over, he would quite happily come and talk and relax with us. And they became as good a friend as they possibly could do under the circumstances.
Not this archetypal, all-in shouting, swearing figure that you sometimes see presented.
No. A lot of shouting, obviously, on the square.
And swearing?
Remarkably little swearing. I don't have any memory, frankly, of foul language in any respect.
Either by the instructors or by the lads?
By the lads, no, indeed not. But I do remember one funny little thing, though, which on the very first night that we were there, and we were putting our beds together, and for the majority of the, well, for a large number of the chaps there, it was their very first night away from home. Those who had not been away to school or perhaps camping and all this of it, and some idiot started singing, "There's no place like home," quietly to himself. And by the time he'd finished the first verse, about three of them were standing by the windows crying away. But that was on the very first night.
No, there
wasn't any homesickness at all, I don't think, really. We were all very delighted to be allowed off after we had, as the expression was, to pass off the square after after 3 weeks there was a passing out, a drill inspection on the square, and provided everybody did their stuff and looked smart and did their, got their full marks, then we were allowed home for the weekend, for a long weekend. So I would say that was the situation. By this stage, of course, we were all pretty fit, well trained. We'd lost the first people who couldn't make the grade, and it was at this stage that those that the authorities considered would make second attendance were sent off to War Office Selection Board.
Now, how did they identify the ones that were most? I mean, what were they looking for? Do you see what I mean? What characteristics did they pick out for people? I mean, and how far was it social class based?
I don't think social class came into it too much. Because there were certainly boys from public school who were not selected to go off. I think by this stage they had got to know us well enough to be able to decide who were the steadiest and the most personable, and those who were not. So,
I can see what you mean about that they didn't automatically just put the public school boys through. But if someone was not from a good background, would that hold them back towards being, you know?
Everybody had at this stage gone through a series of interviews.
And what were those interviews like? What were they looking for?
No, these were carried out by specialists. I can't remember the, but certainly each unit had a small team whose job was to do the selection. So everybody in turn went for an interview or interviews, and depending upon how well you interviewed, then and bearing in mind the recommendation of your own officers, then it was proceeded a little bit further.
Do you remember your own interview?
I don't particularly remember that one, no.
Well, let's move on to the next stage. Would you then go to Wadby?
Yes, indeed, because that was the next course. Sandhurst was still closed. It was still an offshoot. There was no regular army profession for officers at that stage. Those of us who had we went off to War Office Selection Board.
Now,
that's
was
right.
That before you finished.
Yes.
So you went during the course.
Went during the course.
Now, where was the War Office Selection Board? Has it moved? Is it Newbury now? Or
well, that was you're thinking of the regular Army War Office Selection Board.
I am.
Quite different.
Of course, right. Where did you go for your?
I don't know that we actually went anywhere. We were, after a process of selection and interviews, those of us who were selected for OCCHU were told that this was going to happen, and
you
we were
that, right. I understand.
So it wasn't such a thing as a 3-day War Office Selection Board.
Almost back after a while to our typical day. Was there what sort of recreational facilities were there? Was there a canteen or anything that you could go to relax?
Oh, there was the very fine naffy canteen with everything really that one wanted. There was also cinemas in the town, and then the added attraction of the buses into Aldershot and whatever went on there. But we didn't really stray very far from the barracks, really, and the naffy canteen, I suppose.
What did the naffy offer you? What did you need? I mean, it wasn't a wet naffy, I presume.
Yeah, all I can remember basically are large wadges of naffy fruitcake, which was extremely popular, chocolate biscuits. Teas and coffees, and I don't recollect alcohol in any respect at that stage.
Any sort of darts or billiards or anything to games to play or writing materials or anything, or was it just really a cafe?
There were certainly other recreational opportunities. I think the Salvation Army and probably the Church of England had huts on the camp where they provided restrooms for peace and quiet, and where people could go and play music and listen to radios and things like that. But that it was all very simplistic.
And did you ever go into the local town?
I think we used to wander into Deep Cut and walk past the tattoo parlours, which I think had done being very busy. There were a lot of tattoo parlours in Deep Cut, which is just like a little one-horse town, sort of all the shops down one side of the little funny little shops like something out of the Wild West. But there would also, I'm sure, have been a couple of little cafes where we would have gone and had eggs and chips and bacon and things like that.
Now, anything else about your time there? I mean, I'm not quite sure how long you were there. You went there in February 46.
Yeah. We were there until, I should think, August.
Just 6 months.
Yeah, certainly no longer.
And was there a passing out, or,
yes.
End, or did training change, or was it just basically complete?
Well, training developed all the time, but it all led up to a passing out parade.
And what do you remember of the passing out parade?
I don't remember anything about it at all.
There wasn't a big thing that your parents came
down? No.
So what happened then?
We were sent straight off to Okcho, and we went to 127 Okcho, which was in Trentham Park in the Potteries.
Near Stoke.
Yep. And the Regimental Sergeant Major. Regimental Sergeant Major? Coldstream Guards, fine Regimental Sergeant Major there. And
what was the setup of 127 Okcho? What was the intake and how was it organised?
I suppose the intake was probably about 30 of us, and there would be. There must have been several hundred, there must have been 500 or 600 potential officer cadets there at that time, coming in various piers. And we were housed in very cold Nissen huts, and it poured with rain, and it was most unpleasant. And we spent half our time brushing the paths to our Nissen huts free of water.
What was the training program they put you through there, your off to training?
Well, we started off doing our basic Okcho training, lots of lectures, of course, and a lot of basic manoeuvres, but then it all came to a shuddering halt because a number of us were then selected to go to War Office Selection Board, because it was then, Sandhurst was then in preparation for opening in January of the following year. So the powers that be decided that a certain number of us should go to Wasby, and so we went off to the place in Wiltshire.
Newbury or Westbury? I've forgotten myself.
Westbury. Where we spent 3 days in great luxury in a lovely old house, doing all manner of funny bits and pieces.
We're interested in Wasby, because it is how they pick officers.
Mm.
What sort of tests and procedures did they put you through?
Well, we had lots of tests with diagrams and putting holes, putting squares into circles, and dismantling bicycle pumps and putting them together again, manipulation, all sorts of funny odd things, which we wondered ourselves at the time whether there was any much purpose to it.
So that sounds like simple intelligence tests and just practical tests.
That's right, yes.
What about command tests? This business of crossing the imaginary stream and all that?
We did that, and that was, we were given a telegraph pole and 2 50-gallon metal containers and a length of rope, and this was just one of them, and we were split up into groups of 4 or 5 cadets, and each had to take it in turn to do something ridiculous with all these basic items in crossing streams and gullies and whatever, and there was a lot of amusement and a lot of hilarity, and a few accidents as well, because telegraph poles are heavy and unwieldy and could fall and cause a bit of damage to people. But that was certainly an important part of the showing people the initiative.
Did these command tests have a right way of doing it? Or was it more a matter of showing leadership and willingness?
It was not a question of finding the right way, but it was a question of, as you suggest, of showing leadership and control, really being able to control 4 or 5 other of your contemporaries in a leadership manner.
I presume they were also watching to see how you'd react when you were a subordinate, so that you could take orders as well.
Exactly.
Or join a team.
Yeah. It was the actual result of the exercise which we're involved in didn't really matter. It was the way in which the individuals reacted, either in a leadership capacity or as a member of the team. So that was quite important. There were also quite a lot of discussion groups when people had to have a discussion group of, let us say, 10 or 12 cadets, and each would be told to talk for 10 minutes on a specific subject, either of their own choice or of the instructor's choice. That I found as an 18-year-old a little daunting, but we all got around it one way or other. Some people did it very efficiently and very effectively. I'm sure others of us stuttered and stalled our way through it.
What were they testing here?
I think ability to communicate. Then there were... several interviews as well with different people from major generals downwards.
Remember anything about the interviews? What sort of things they were asking you?
They were asking the sort of question you've been asking, really. they were very interested in background, and particularly military background, interests and hobbies, that sort of thing. So it was a fascinating period, and then at the end of it, we were all put back onto our three-ton lorries, taken to the station, and disappeared back to our units. And very quickly, those of us who had qualified were put out of our misery. And
you told you that.
Went indeed, and were sent home on leave with instructions then to report to the Royal Army Educational Corps at Beaconsfield.
So that was the end of your time at 127 Octave.
Yeah.
For you, that never really started. How long were you there for?
Only a very short period, a couple of months perhaps.
So just August to...
August to September.
Now, so you attended the WASB, that would be when? That would be September, I presume. Or October?
No, that would be in September, I would think, yes. Because by the winter of that year, we were back in wooden huts on Salisbury Plain with the Educational Corps.
Now, tell me about this role. It's the Royal Army Educational, and that was where, sorry?
It's on Salisbury Plain. You mentioned Beaconsfield. Is Beaconsfield on Salisbury Plain?
I'm not sure, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. That's where it was, though, was it Beaconsfield?
I think it was Beaconsfield, yes. It was certainly on Salisbury Plain.
Now, what was the nature of this? I'm not familiar with this establishment at all.
No, I'm sure you're not.
What was it?
It was a holding unit for us to brush up on our basic educational knowledge prior to going to the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst.
In January.
47. So this was the worst winter of many years. So we were there in, I suppose it must have been October, November, and part of December 1947, yes.
46.
46, yeah.
It's that winter.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a very bad winter, and it, apart from we were living in pretty basic accommodation, they were either Nissen huts, a combination of Nissen huts and wooden huts, and it snowed constantly, and it was the coldest winter for years.
Now, how bad was it?
It was extraordinarily bad. And we had to, I remember, we would have to make gigantic snowballs about 4 or 5 feet in diameter to roll these around the barrack square to allow us to get some area to actually margin. We were so short of fuel that at night all these budding British Army officers would sneak out of their huts and break down the perimeter wooden fence and take the wood back to burn on the stoves. It was absolutely miserable. There wasn't enough fuel to in the rations to keep us warm.